Will America's future and the future of the world be more or less entrepreneurial? There are three overarching influences that will determine the answer. Professor Arthur Diamond explores them.
This is the Economics for Entrepreneurs podcast, a project of the Mises Institute, applying the principles of economics to start, grow, and manage your business. For free tools, resources, key takeaways, and actionable insights from each episode, visit Mises.org/E4EPod. Now, here's Hunter Hastings.
Hi, Hunter Hastings here. Entrepreneurship is the engine of economic growth in the dynamic economy. In fact, entrepreneurship is the dynamism of the economy. Entrepreneurs read signals from consumers and customers that things could be better, cheaper, faster, more convenient, more capable, more efficient, more effective, better tasting, more enabling, more empowering. And they set out to design, produce, and offer those innovations and improvements for sale on the market. Each entrepreneur and entrepreneurial company, small, medium, or large, seeks to find its special, unique role in addressing customer wants. And we become graced with an all-encompassing network of interconnected improvements and innovation, making our entire economic system devoted to making lives better. Improvement is all positive. It's economic growth, it's life enhancement, dynamism, movement, advancement, betterment, enriching, empowering, elevating. It's higher standards of living for everyone, new horizons, great ideas, expansive opportunities. Improvement is also a comparative term. If something is new and an improvement, it replaces the old thing that is now unimproved, old-fashioned, inefficient, less effective, not new, and no longer good enough. This can be viewed as negative from the point of view of invested capital or existing factories or historical market share or jobs or marketplace acceptance and even personal prestige. Austrian economics, as always, is our friend in this environment. It guides the entrepreneur to always be a part of the dynamic process, not to wait to be rendered unimproved and inefficient relative to some new innovator, but always to be the innovator, continuously improving and never being leapfrogged. Austrian entrepreneurs are leaders in innovative dynamism. But other perspectives have focused on the negative, on those who are leapfrogged, left behind, rendered inefficient or less effective or not new. One term for this negativity that has caught on in the popular vernacular and popular imagination is creative destruction. The enemies of entrepreneurship seize on the idea of destruction and tend to forget about the creative part. The expression was coined by Joseph Schumpeter, a man who believed, as he stated in the book that contains the phrase, that capitalism will not survive. He might have been right in the sense that the enemies of capitalism use the idea of destruction as a weapon of criticism. Another closely related term is disruption. That was popularized by Clayton Christensen, who used it in a more positive sense, the capability of new entrepreneurial firms to enter industries at an affordable point, offering better, cheaper services to a peripheral part of the market. He called those customers the underserved, and leapfrogging from that entry point to a fast-growing and potentially dominant position. The incumbents who are leapfrogged are said to be disrupted, another term for destruction. There's a danger that the mental picture of entrepreneurship becomes associated with this negative perspective. We could call that negativity a lack of cultural support for entrepreneurship. That, in turn, could lead to a lack of institutional support for entrepreneurship, which translates into active restriction of entrepreneurial possibilities through regulation, legislation, and anti-entrepreneurial decisions in the legal process. Professor Arthur Diamond is the author of a book about this problem, titled Openness to Creative Destruction, with the subtitle Sustaining Innovative Dynamism. He is advocating for more positive cultural, institutional, and legal support for entrepreneurship. Professor Diamond teaches economics and entrepreneurship at the University of Nebraska, Omaha, and he holds graduate degrees in economics and philosophy from the University of Chicago. And he's kindly allowed us to talk to him today about his new book. Professor Diamond, hello.
Hello, Hunter.
Thank you for visiting us at Economics for Entrepreneurs today. You've given me permission to call you Art, so I'm going to do that throughout and reassure our listeners I'm not showing any disrespect.
Anything but arty is fine.
Okay. In your book, Openness to Creative Destruction, Sustaining Innovative Dynamism, you write about three things: the culture, the institutions, and the governance of entrepreneurship. And I'd like to start there today, Art, and get your perspective on the current state of culture, institutions, and governance in support of entrepreneurship today, specifically in America. And I took it that you're implying that support for the vital role of entrepreneurship is eroding, but I don't want to put any words in your mouth, and I want to ask you if that's how you see it.
Well, I think there are many worrisome signs, and some of them are well known. We have one leading presidential candidate who is openly a socialist, and we have several others who agree with him on a great many policy issues, including, I think, some that are going to be harmful to entrepreneurs if they are implemented, and harmful to the general population, because entrepreneurs are necessary for growth and human betterment. We have other signs that are worrisome. There's been a long-term trend with only a couple of small pauses over many decades of increasing regulations. And I think of all the policies that matter for entrepreneurship, regulations are one of the ones that hurt the most. We have an acceptance of the view that among academics that bigger government is better. That's been true for a long while, but I think it's even a little bit more true now than it has been in recent decades. And in addition to being perhaps a little bit more true now, I think there's perhaps less tolerance on some campuses of allowing the other side to speak their piece. And I think that's a really bad sign in terms of the marketplace of ideas, in terms of openness of discussion. One thing that I think matters that's maybe a little bit more subtle, that's also a worrisome sign, is that that people seem to think that entrepreneurs need to apologize for what they're doing in some ways. You always hear this phrase that they need to give back. And right. Bill Gates is praised more for his charitable work than he's praised for the great contributions he did to help create computers and internet. And I think that's got things backwards. So you can see a lot of threats, and I don't want to overwhelm with the threats, because I think there's positives too. But symbolically in the book, one thing I emphasize in the preface is with our regulations, we've even gone so far as to ban the symbol, the traditional symbol of invention, which is the incandescent light bulb. But perhaps a little thread of hope is that I've seen that there's recent initiative to reduce the ban a little bit. So there's always there's pluses and minuses, but in the long run, I think there's hope, because I think that at some fundamental level, people want some of the same things. People want freedom. People want to make a life better for themselves and their children. And we can make a strong case that the way to achieve that is through innovative dynamism and through more entrepreneurship. So I don't want to paint a picture that causes despair. I think there's hope, but I do think there's plenty of signs that we need to worry.
Oh, one of the thoughts in your book is that this term that Schumpeter coined, creative destruction, gives people the opportunity to focus on the negative, the destruction part. And you prefer this term innovative dynamism. And that's much more positive. And one of the phrases we like here a lot is Professor McCloskey's phrase of 3,000% improvement in standards of living over 200 years. And people seem to ignore or perhaps even reject this idea that capitalism is raising all the boats, is improving everybody's lives, is innovative and dynamic. So You've talked about their rejection of the negatives of entrepreneurship. Why don't they pick up on the positives?
I thought about that a lot, and I make some of the same points, although not as eloquently as George McCloskey, about the huge gains in life, the betterment that has occurred, what she called in an earlier book, the great fact. I kind of like that better than her new phrase, the great enrichment, because I think that gives away the story. I like to have people ponder and wonder on the edge of their chairs, what's this great fact going to be? But I think, and it is so overwhelming, but it's been told by many people recently. There's a Matt Ridley's book, The Irrational Optimist. There's a book by Steven Pinker. Of course, you already mentioned Deirdre McCloskey, and I do a little bit in mine. And yet, and it might seem as though the message is not getting through, and that may be partly true. But I've thought about it recently, and I think maybe partly what's going on is people think of, that it's true, but they shrug and say, okay, that's great. We realize that. But what matters to us is what have you done for us lately, and what are you going to do for us in the future? And even though we've come a long way, they think there are signs to worry about in our current economy that maybe the riches that have been delivered in the past, the betterment in the past, are not going to be continued. So I think that may be part of it. I think another part of it is sometimes this is presented in terms that are rather abstract, so that you have a graph, and the graph shows some estimates of gross domestic product. And it's going up dramatically. And when people think of it in that abstract term, I think they think, well, we're just piling on materialistic riches that we don't really need, and that maybe that's no longer adding as much to our lives as it did at earlier stages. So one of the things I try to do in my book is I try to drill down to the details. I say, well, let's not look at it as a chart with something abstract like gross domestic product. Let's think about cars. And let's think about what do cars allow you to do. They allow you to have a wider range of job choice. They allow you to see relatives more frequently and friends more frequently. They allow you to go somewhere when you want to, not when the train decides it's leaving. And I look at air conditioning and I say, okay, air conditioning, that means that lives have been saved of fragile people who would die from the heat. That means that you can have more productivity from people who would work more slowly and with greater danger to themselves and to others if they were in a really hot environment. That means people are less grumpy. There have been studies done that when people are hot, baseball pitchers throw more beanballs, drivers honk the horn more, people on the streets attack other people on the streets more frequently. Heat causes violence, it causes death from illness, it causes lower productivity, and comfort is not something to be totally ignored. People are more comfortable. But also in terms of the better, you know, the fulfilling life, the creative life, which I emphasize in my book some as an important alternative plan of life, that if you want to write the great American novel or paint the great American painting or any of those creative activities, it's easier to have the mental sharpness that you need to do some of those activities if you have air conditioning. So I go through I go through the detailed examples of innovation, not just some abstract quantity, to say that, yes, these are things that matter, and they matter because they help people achieve things they want to achieve in their lives. And I think if you can make it more concrete, then maybe people wouldn't be so blasé, as you're suggesting, I think accurately they sometimes are, about how much we've achieved. Even recently, because many of the things I'm mentioning are things that have happened within the lifetime of people currently alive. And it's not within the last 5 or 10 years, although even then you can talk about iPhones, and you can talk about how iPhones have given us more control of our lives. We have to wait in a line. We can listen to music that's on our iPhone. We can have access to all kinds of information. I tend to get lost when I'm going from one place to another. I can turn on my iPhone and tell me how to get where I need to go. If we drill down and give examples, maybe we can turn around some of the attitude that this is something that is in the past, and maybe that we have as much as we need. It's something that's in the past, but it's also in the present. And boy, we could still use more of it. There's room for improvement.
Yeah, and very much in the future. You should defer to no one in your eloquence, Art. That was a very eloquent description of what we'd call in the Austrian school subjective value. And one of the challenges is a measurement challenge, as you say. The charts and graphs are very abstract, and what you described is an impact on individual quality of life, and we've got to find a way to communicate that. You're right. Let's break down the terms that we introduce: culture and institutions and regulation, and start with culture. I could say that there's a lot of spotlight on the culture of dynamism in this country. We celebrate entrepreneurs like Elon Musk. He's kind of a rock star. And there's Jeff Bezos and Peter Thiel and Reed Hastings and Taylor Swift, I think, is a good example. There's television shows about entrepreneurship. So don't we really celebrate entrepreneurship in our culture?
I think we sometimes do. I think it's selective and fickle. You think about Steve Jobs is celebrated, although he's also attacked. And that's true also of Elon Musk. Jeff Bezos was celebrated a fair amount. I mean, there's a lot of skepticism about him to begin with. People thought that he was going to collapse, but then he kept going and then he started to be praised. But now, at least in some parts of the country, like New York City, he's being criticized strongly. I do think that our culture does admire heroes. And I think that there is a substantial heroic element to what many of the innovative entrepreneurs in our history have achieved. And so when I talk about turning around the culture toward more sympathy toward entrepreneurship, I think one of the best ways that could be done is not with abstract graphs of GDP, but by telling the life stories, the struggles, the hardships, the perseverance of the entrepreneurs. And I try to do that quite a bit in my book. I tell about the Wright brothers and what they went through at Kitty Hawk with the swarms of mosquitoes and the winds blowing their tents over and the heat and the fragility of the water supply and the skepticism of the experts and how they persisted and they frugally saved their money from their bicycle shop to finance their 3 years of trips to Kitty Hawk. And in contrast to Langley, who had gotten a $70,000 subsidy from the federal government for his machine and then promptly crashed into the Potomac, they saved $1,000 from their bicycle shop to finance their trip. And they did everything that needed to be done, and it wasn't easy, and they succeeded. And I think when you read their stories, there's a wonderful book by David McCulloch, who's one of our great nonfiction writers. And it's called The Wright Brothers. And it tells the story that I was just very, very briefly saying. And when you read it, you end up saying, boy, I wish there were people like that, more people, or maybe I wish I could be somebody like that and have those kinds of traits and fight that hard to do something that matters that much. And I when I think about turning the culture around, I think one of the greatest hopes is to have these stories be better known. So I try to do that in my book. I'm also trying to do that in other ways. I have an op-ed piece that just came out yesterday, but is going to appear in a few other places on the Wright brothers. In about a week, on September 29th, that's going to be the 110th anniversary of Wilbur Wright flying an airplane for the first time over the island of Manhattan. And they say that almost a million Manhattanites rushed to the streets to see that, cheering. And so I make that. And then in this little piece, I talk about a little bit about the struggles that they went through. But I also talk about why flight is a good thing. You know, it's another way. We have people today criticizing it, right? There were people who want to ban flight. But flight, again, allows us more choice. It allows us to trade and interact with more people. It allows us to get medicines to places where they're needed, when they're needed. And so if you tell these stories, these detailed stories about the struggles, and the Wright story's got another aspect that's wonderful too, is these were not privileged people born with silver spoons in their mouths. These were people who came from very modest backgrounds, the Wright brothers. And that's true in case after case of great innovative entrepreneurs. It's true of Walt Disney. It's true of John D. Rockefeller. It's even true more recently of people like Steve Jobs. Or you think about an extreme case, Harold Hamm, one of the key people behind fracking. He was the 13th child of sharecroppers. And it was a real rough and tumble kind of a person, but he did great things. And so you see these stories where people do great things by sometimes old-fashioned values, and it's a great path not only to make our lives better, but it made their lives better. And they started out with lives that were not all that great in some way. So I think the way to change culture, in one way at least, an important way, is to make sure some of these stories are better known. And they're true stories, and they're important stories. And it's not the usual methodology of economics, because economics wants you to run regressions and do mathematical theory. But I don't, and that can be important. I'm not ruling that out. But I think the flesh and blood stories of real people matter too.
Professor Diamond tells a nice story about the entrepreneurial journey of Lewis and Regina. Our online course will help you chart out your own journey so that you can tell your own story. Find it at learn.economicsforentrepreneurs.com. That's learn.economicsforentrepreneurs.com. And now let's go back and hear more entrepreneurial journey stories. That's inspiring. And again, in Austrian economics, we're a science of words, not of numbers. So we should be able to find a way to tell those heroic stories. And that's a great theme. I would challenge you to open it up a little bit more. And we like to include the 97%. The 97% of all businesses in the U.S. are what the government calls somewhat demeaningly small business. But they're potentially dynamic. They're involved in continuous change and improvement. They're trying to improve their customers' lives so they can be successful. So can we tell the heroic story about small business as well, Art?
Well, one story I tell that I think would fit that, I tell a couple of stories that I think are would apply to small business. One of them has to do with Lewis and Regina Borgenicht. They were immigrants from Germany in the 1800s, went to New York City, and they had skills at sewing, and they purchased a used, beat-up sewing machine, and they needed to find a way to support themselves in New York. So the story is that Lewis Borgnick went out in the streets to see what clothing was being sold and how well various items were selling. And so he walked around the streets for a while, and he noticed that there were high-quality, fancy, expensive girls' aprons being sold. But one thing he didn't see being sold was simple, well-made, inexpensive girls' aprons. So he had the idea that maybe there, he thought, we know how to make that. We that's something our skills and our sewing machine will allow us to make. And he guessed that there would be a market for that if sold at a low price. So he went and bought some cloth, took it home to his wife. They stayed up all night sewing. And then the next morning, he went out into the streets and offered them for a price that would make a decent profit, but was a lot cheaper than the fancy aprons that were being sold. And he sold out very quickly, and he was elated. So he went back to his their little apartment, and he hugged his wife, and they danced around the apartment. And then they got to work making more aprons. So, I mean, you can tell that's not maybe as dramatic as flying over Manhattan, but it's making your life better and making your customers' lives better. And it's entrepreneurship, and it involves some of the characteristics we think of entrepreneurs. It involves hope and hard work and alertness. And I think that Lewis and Regina Borgnick were heroes. I also tell the story of Jacob Davis. Jacob Davis came over. I'm not sure it was Germany, somewhere in Europe, from somewhere in Europe in the 1800s. And he was mainly a tailor, but he tried doing other things too, and moved from town to town in Canada and the United States for a period of time. And he ended up, I think it was in Reno, as a little tailor shop. And mainly what he was making was horse blankets, of all things. He was making sturdy horse blankets, and he used rivets to enforce the parts that were most fragile. A poor woman came in, desperate, and said, "My husband can't work because he wears his work pants and they fall apart within a day or two. And we can't keep buying these work pants, but he needs to work so that we can survive. Can you make me a pair of pants for him that won't fall apart immediately?" So he said, "Well, you know, I'll give that a try." And he thought about it, about how, what he could do to make stronger pants for this big burly guy who needed them. And he had an idea. He saw the rivets he'd been using on the horse blankets. And he said, "Well, what if I put some rivets at the key places in these pants where they tend to fall apart when this guy wears them?" So he did that. And the woman came, picked him up, paid the little bit of money that he asked her for him. But then she came back a day or two later and she said, "You saved us. This is wonderful. My husband can work, and he comes home and the pants are still intact and he can go back to work the next day." And she was telling her friends and acquaintances, "Go buy this kind of pant from Jacob Davis because it's really great." And so he started to have, you know, more customers than he could deal with. And it occurred to him, he was onto something. He had tried to patent a few things in the past that had never gone anywhere. So his wife was not too happy about him taking some of their little money and taking out another patent. But he thought maybe this idea was one worth patenting. So he had heard about a retailer who he thought he might be able to interest in San Francisco. So he went to San Francisco and met up with a guy named Levi. And he said, "Well, here's my idea. Here's some pants. Here's what I'm making. How about you pay for the patent and we'll split the earnings from this 50-50. And Levi said, "Yeah, I think that's a good idea. Let's give that a shot." And so Levi Jeans were born. Well, this guy, Jacob Davis, he was a small business person. He was somebody, and it shows that there's a continuum. In my book, I distinguish between free agent entrepreneurs, who I think are more or less the same as what you're calling small business people, and innovative entrepreneurs. And I emphasize most the innovative entrepreneurs. And if I have to have a hierarchy, I think they're the ones who cause the great leaps that result in the greatest advances in human betterment. But I sure think that the small business people are solid citizens too. And there's a wide range of them. Some of them innovate a lot. Some of them innovate very little. I go to some restaurants that I went to 30 years ago, and they're pretty much the same restaurant doing the same thing the same way. So not every small business is hugely innovative, but some are, and there's a continuum. And oftentimes the small businesses are the fertile beginning place for the people who eventually become the innovative entrepreneurs. I mean, one common stepping stone to entrepreneurship, higher levels of entrepreneurship, is to start out as a boy or a girl being a paper boy, selling newspapers. And there's a lot of cases like with that was what Walt Disney did when he was very young. And you learn some of the basic skills and habits and character traits you need to be a successful entrepreneur if you're doing that. You have to get up every morning, and you have to be reliable, and you have to work hard, and you have to judge your customers. You have to, because the way that the paperboy business worked, I'm not sure if it still does this now, but they had to buy their papers, and then if they didn't sell them all, they were out what they had spent for buying those papers.
Right. You learn cash flow management.
Right. And you learn, okay, if this is a big news day, I'm going to buy more.
Yeah.
Because I'll be able to sell more. And so you learn which customers are interested in which kind of stories. So as you're yelling the news story to attract customers, you get to know your customers and their interests. And that helps you then become in your next steps toward entrepreneurship. So I think small business is very important. I think that it's important in and of itself because it provides people the opportunity to be their own boss. And they do a lot of surveys, and other things equal, if you compare people who are working for an employer at a job or people who are their own boss doing something similar, the people who are their own boss, even though there are challenges, they're happier. They report being happier. And when you ask them why, they often say, "I like to be in control of my life." And there's a guy named Engelhardt, an academic, who's done surveys around the world with a bunch of different co-authors. And he finds that there are people have different values in some ways, but they have some similar values too. And one of the similar values across the world, he finds, is people like to be in control. They like to have choice. And if you are an entrepreneur, either of the free agent sort or the innovative sort, you have choice. You have more control over your life. And I think that's something we celebrate entrepreneurship largely because of the goods it produces for consumers. But I think maybe an underemphasized reason to celebrate entrepreneurship is because of the satisfaction of being an entrepreneur, that it provides you with a fulfilling, creative kind of activity that people enjoy and for many people leads to happiness.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that there's a trio of terms like that: mastery, control, and meaning, that you specialize in something and get mastery of it. You're in control of your own opportunities, and there's meaning in following the economic hero's life.
I like that.
You talk about innovation in small business. One of our early guests was Bob Luddy, and he started a company called Captive Air that deals in restaurant kitchen ventilation systems, which sounds, you know, less romantic than some other things he could be doing. But he talks about innovating every day, making the system better, making the integration better, helping customers better. He's innovated in organization. He's innovated in speed. He's innovated in responsiveness. And so I think every small business can be that innovative.
I agree.
I wanted to switch to the second one of your subjects, because it's one that concerns us a little bit, and that's regulation. And you say some very specific and outspoken things, I would say, in your book about the damage that is done to the dynamic entrepreneurial process by restrictive regulation. And sometimes that's to protect large incumbents from exactly the innovative dynamism that you're preferring. So let's talk about that a little bit. What's your point of view? What are some examples you would cite, and how big of a problem is this in your viewpoint?
I think it's a huge problem. I talk about two different reasons why we have regulations, and I think oftentimes it's hard to say in a particular case which is more important, because often they're both at work. One sort is well-meaning people, well-intentioned people, who see a regulation as a way of protecting consumers or workers from harm. And then the other kind of motive is the kind that you suggested a minute ago, which is the incumbents in a business will often favor regulations, maybe saying that their reason is they want to protect consumers, but where we strongly suspect that the real reason is that they want to restrict competition. And I think both of these are in effect, but I think for the regulations to exist and persist and be sustained, you very often have to have the first reason, enough people convinced of the first reason, the protection reason. And so I spend a fair amount of time on that, and I probably even discuss that more than I do the more cynical, but probably a very often true reason of trying to keep competitors out. And I talk some about the precautionary principle being that increasingly motivates the kinds of regulations we have, where you can't allow an innovation to exist according to the precautionary principle unless the innovator can prove in advance that there won't be anybody harmed by the innovation. But of course, the problem is that if you think about and this is something I try to go into in the book, is what is the process of innovation? How do we achieve these? How do the entrepreneurs achieve innovations? Well, I focus on unexpected serendipity. I focus on hunches that are vague to begin with, but that have to be worked out sometimes over long periods of time. And I focus on trial and error experiments. Each of these is hard to predict. And if it's hard to predict, it's then going to be impossible to prove in advance that there isn't going to be some harm. So what you do is, if you really seriously try to enforce the precautionary principle, and increasingly people are often trying to do that, then you are basically shutting down, or at least extremely, to an extreme extent, slowing down innovation. And there have been cases, you can give a lot of cases, historical and contemporary, of where this has happened, and in big cases and small cases. There is a nice book about Edison's installation of electricity and innovation of electricity in the United States, and the guy author's name is Freeberg. He compares the United States with Europe, and he said, even though Europe at that point was at least as well off as the United States, it was much slower to get electricity installed in the cities. And that's because we had a much more venturesome attitude toward allowing the trial and error that that was necessary for this to be developed. There's a great example of different attitudes of people toward some new innovation, especially in regards to the possible harm. In the early days, they weren't quite sure how to wire houses. And so sometimes there were accidents that were not pleasant and sometimes even somewhat dangerous. For instance, a fire started in the wiring of the Vanderbilt's house. And at that point, Mrs. Vanderbilt decided, I'm not in favor of this electricity innovation. And she had the wires pulled out and they put back their gas lighting. At about the same time, Edison tried to install electricity in the library of Morgan, the famous financier, and they started a fire in his library. So the guy who was installing it for the Edison company, I can't remember his name now, maybe it was Johnson, but I'm not sure I remember. Anyway, he was called in front of Morgan, and this was pretty intimidating because this is one of the richest people around and had a very strong personality, and he was sure he was going to be, you know, yelled at and told to get out and never appear again. So he goes in, and Morgan's sitting there in this library with the smoke still coming from parts of it, I guess. And and Johnson looks at him and he says, you know, we messed up, but here's what went wrong, and here's how I think we could do it better, and this is what we do differently. And so apparently then Morgan sits there for a minute and stares at him, and he says, see that you do. And then he walks out. Well, Morgan was a venturesome consumer. He was somebody who knew that with new things, they're not necessarily going to be perfect at the beginning, but he wanted to be part of the process of innovation. We emphasize the entrepreneurs. We should, because they're the main agent. But we don't, once in a while, I think we should emphasize a little bit more, and this is something that Amar Bidet does somewhat, is we should emphasize that a key in the United States is also the venturesome consumer. Those who've been willing to go along with products at the early stages when there are flaws and when it's not fully known what harms there may be, and who are willing to provide a market and funding by buying these products that are very imperfect at the early stages so that they can be improved and developed so that the more cautious people can jump on later on and have the advantage of these products without some of the, you know, potential harm.
Yeah, that's a great thought for the innovative culture, the venturesome consumer. Right. It's kind of like the early adopters in that old crossing the chasm picture.
Right. I'm not familiar with that picture, but
there's a theory about the adoption of new technologies, and there's an early group. They're called early adopters, so they're willing to put up with the flaws, sure, as you say, in order to sample the benefits and be one of the early users. And then there's what they call a huge chasm before you get to the next stage of adoption. And so it's called
crushing chasm.
It's called crossing the chasm.
That's a nice phrase. Yeah. But I've gotten, you asked me about examples of regulation.
Yeah.
There was this poor guy who had this idea, and I don't know if it was a good idea or not. I thought maybe it might be a good idea. He said you might get germs if you when you open a door or when you push buttons on an ATM machine or such. So he had this little hook-like device that would allow you to do those things without actually with your fingers touching them. And to reduce the contamination of this device, he put little specks of silver in his hook. And it turns out that the EPA had, in some previous precedent, had identified that as some kind of a pesticide or something. And so he sought guidance from the EPA. If I produce my little product, am I going to be in violation of the EPA regulations? Well, he was delayed a huge amount and had to stop production because he couldn't get the EPA to bless his little product and say, yes, go ahead. It's, you know, trivial use of the silver. It's not going to do any harm. Of course, go ahead and do it. That's what you'd expect based on common sense, right? But he couldn't get the EPA to say anything, and he didn't want to start producing these things and all of a sudden have them come and say, you know, we're going to seize your product because you're violating some law. You can't sell it. So that's a little example. There's been stuff written and a lot of concern about regulations of drones more recently. And there's a funny example in the book, a minor example, but there was a regulation. I don't know if it still exists or not, but for a while, there was a regulation that said that every drone had to have on board a user manual. It's not entirely clear
who's going to run
this unmanned drone is going to be reading the onboard user manual that was being mandated by the regulations. But there's other regulations besides that one. And some people have said that's the reason why, even though we were the ones who initiated drones, but why the advances now are happening in other countries that are being more open to this new technology, not regulated so far.
To innovation,
One of the most important examples I give is near the end of the book, and this is from an area that I think is extremely important, which is the area of healthcare. And this is an area where we use this precautionary principle quite a bit, and I think it slows cures to diseases, and that means people are living shorter and less healthy lives than they would need to. I give an extended example in the second half of the last chapter where I talk about cancer and how we still have a long way to go before we can say we have fully cured all cancers. That was a hope we had back when the government declared a war on cancer in the 1960s. And they thought within a couple decades, we'd achieve it. And we haven't gotten there. What I go through in the last part of the book is I show who are the people who have made advances in the past and what kind of people were they and how did they think and how did they act? In other words, these are medical entrepreneurs that we're looking at. And it turns out they had the same characteristics, the same thinking and actions as other entrepreneurs, innovators that I talked about earlier in the book. In other words, they take advantage and they're alert to serendipitous events. They have hunches that they follow up on and pursue. They do trial and error experiments. I focus especially on this last one because there were a couple of medical entrepreneurs, in particular, a guy named Emil Freireich, was one of the heroes in this story, and he decided he was determined to cure childhood leukemia, and so he and his team put together a chemo cocktail and administered it to children with leukemia, and it had a lot of side effects. So he was very unpopular among his peers. They almost shut him down. He almost got fired more than once, but he and his team persisted, and they were intense. They had intense meetings. They met once a week. And argued and debated and yelled at each other and grabbed the chalk from each other about how to tweak the formula, what drugs to include, what doses to include. Then they would observe what the effects were on the children. And then they would, the next week or maybe 2 weeks later, they would adjust it again. And for a while, they were just getting side effects and they weren't getting cures. And they almost, you know, were forced to stop. But eventually, they started to cure some, not just remissions, but they actually started to have some children they cured. And one of the people who had observed this was a young doctor who had attended the meetings of this group. His buddy was a smart aleck, and he had labeled this group the Society of Jabbering Idiots. It's a Freireich's group, right?
Yeah.
And they were making snide remarks under their breath. A guy named Vince DeVita and the guy who had the pejorative label. And they thought, well, these are fun to go to. This is entertaining watching these people make fools themselves. But at some point, DeVita realized he was going to these weekly meetings not because of the entertainment value. He was going to it because they were actually curing cancer. And so he decided that he wanted to become a member of the Society of Jabbering Idiots too. And he chose as the disease that he was going to go after, the version of the brand of cancer, he was going to see what he could do with Hodgkin's lymphoma. So he got together the resources and the team. And he did a similar sort of effort to what Freireich had did with childhood leukemia. He did trial and error adjustment of the form. Nimble trial and error. That's what entrepreneurs often do. Yeah. He's got this book that he wrote about 3 years ago, DeVita does, called The Death of Cancer. And he's got one of the last chapters, next to last maybe. He's got this passionate story about the FDA is now forbidding the kind of nimble trial and error that worked for Freyreich and worked for DeVita himself in curing the kinds of cancer they were going after. And he says, there are people dying today who don't have to be dying because we are keeping the medical entrepreneurs from doing the nimble trial and error that in the past has succeeded and we have every reason to believe would succeed again. And this applies not just to the chemotherapy. There's a nice book by a guy named Rosenberg, Steven Rosenberg, who's one of the key figures behind the currently promising approach of immunotherapy with cancer. And he's got passages in his autobiography where he talks about how he was almost driven to giving up by how frustrating to his morale the Food and Drug Administration was when he would go and try to get approval to administer the latest attempt at immunotherapy. And a lot of times they would delay so long that by the time they approved, when they actually did approve, it was too late because the cells he prepared to do in the immunotherapy were no longer viable to test because he had to go through this procedure. He was spending so much of his psychic, emotional, and other energy debating with the FDA rather than actually attending to his patients and to his innovations. So there's a lot of examples of, can I give other examples within finance, within labor economics, of regulations of the harm they do to innovation. To me, some of the most powerful have to do with health, because when I defend air conditioning, you can find people who plausibly are opposed to air conditioning. And when I defend cars, you can find people who are plausibly opposed to cars. But I haven't run into very many people who are in favor of cancer.
Right.
And so I think it's one of our powerful cases you can make is that, you know, innovation matters in a lot of different ways, but boy, does it matter with health.
Yeah, you're right. It also points out the tremendous cost of time when one of the impacts of these regulators and bureaucrats is just delay. Maybe they eventually get to approval, but during that delay time, people die and experiments can't happen and so on. So that's another aspect. But you've created a new principle, which I can relate to healthcare. So you talked about the venturesome consumer, that we should encourage them. And one of the things that's happened in the health world is this idea of the right to try, that the bureaucrats cannot prevent someone with a terminal disease or some other acute need from trying something that the medics have invented, just because they're regulatorily opposed to it. So we might be able to make that a general principle. The venturesome consumer can opt out of regulation and choose to try innovation. I like that thought.
I think that's a positive development. I have read, unfortunately, though, that it hasn't had as much positive effect as people hoped and thought it would. And part of the reason for that is, my understanding is the way that law was set up is it allows drug companies to provide some of these drugs to people who have lost, don't have any other options and who agree to be venturesome. But what it doesn't allow is it doesn't allow the drug company to charge anything for the drug. And so the drug companies need to survive. And so they sometimes do provide the drugs free, but sometimes if the drugs are very hard to produce, just the fact that they are allowed to give it for free and the patient in these circumstances is allowed to consume it doesn't always mean that it's actually available, because the firms then don't have always the resources to be giving this away for free.
Right.
So I think that what you're talking about, the right to try initiative, has gone in the right direction. It's a step in the right direction, but I think there's still more that needs to be done.
Right, right, sure. Let's talk about a third leg of governance of entrepreneurship, and that's the law. We can make a link to medicine because doctors fear the medical liability lawsuits as much as anything, but also generally, I kind of get the sense that the law has turned against the entrepreneur. So people will sue for missing quarterly earnings targets that have been announced, and activist investors will try and bust up boards. And generally, it seems like there's a lot of legal liability for entrepreneurs. So talk about the legal aspects of the governance of entrepreneurship today.
I was once fortunate to have a leading innovative entrepreneur in my hometown here of Omaha, a fellow named Joe Ricketts, who is the founding entrepreneur behind Ameritrade, the online brokerage firm, agreed to come and talk to one of my EMBA classes. And he did a wonderful job of talking about the early days and how they counted paperclips because they were so frugal. And he did a really wonderful job. And one thing he said that I remember and that I've always puzzled about and thought I should think more about was somebody asked him, maybe me, what's the biggest threat to entrepreneurship right now, to innovative entrepreneurship? And his answer surprised me. He said he thought it was lawsuits, suits for torts, where there's damages, and especially class action lawsuits. And he gave as one example a case that had happened. This is years ago, so I don't know how much people remember it, but there was a case where a woman had spilled some very hot coffee from McDonald's on herself, and I think had been harmed by that.
Right.
And so he sued, and I can't remember the outcome, but I think she might have been given several million dollars. And I think that what he had in mind, being in the brokerage business, is that there were cases where people would sue the brokerage if they made a bad investment. And they'd say, "Well, you should have saved me from it," and such. So you can think in different enterprises, there might be greater risk of the kind of lawsuit from people blaming the provider of product for what they then go ahead and do with the product. And I think this is a difficult issue, and I do think there's something to it. Part of my problem in dealing with it, the way I've set things up in my book, is related back to the question you asked me before this, when you asked about regulations. And I do think that people would like to have some way of being made whole, or at least being compensated, if somebody is totally irresponsible in providing a good or service. And the way that I suggest in the book is that there be something that John Chisholm has called organic regulation. By that, he means not imposed regulation like the kind of government regulation, but he means the mechanisms by which people do have some recourse. And one of those is that if somebody has been totally irresponsible and has not used what the common law judges to be a reasonable standard of care and conscientiousness, then you're allowed to sue them for damages. And I view that as the common law has developed it, common sense, particular cases accumulated over time, that is a better way to handle the most outrageous cases of carelessness that are hard for anybody to justify, as opposed to having these broad regulations that stop innovation and that go against everybody, the conscientious and the unconscientious. So I don't want to shut down tort law completely, because I think it does have a function. So then I think, how do you deal with it? And this is something I don't really talk about in my book. I think you pointed out a gap that if I do a second edition and if they allow me more pages, that's part of my problem, is they told me to cut some of the pages I had rather than allowing me to add them. So I'd have to figure out, where I'd add or have even smaller print. But I think that what I would probably argue for would be some kinds of reforms. For instance, there have been reforms for tort law where they've capped punitive damages. One of the hard things for entrepreneurs with these lawsuits isn't the part where you try to measure and come up with a measure of what the actual harm is and then compensate for that. Part of it is when the juries go wild punishing people that they're not enthused about by having these huge punitive damages. And there's no rhyme or reason for deciding how big those are. And that can be real scary. That can put your company out of business. And those can make a difference. What they did in Texas was they put a cap on how much malpractice cases can receive, a cap of $250,000. And I saw an article a few years after that that said in the following 3 years, they had an extra, beyond what they normally would have had, an extra 7,000 doctors set up practice in Texas. And I thought that makes sense. That people want to practice in a place where they kind of know what the rules are, and they know that they're not going to randomly be put out of business by a jury that's not feeling happy that day. And so Texas is I think in that kind of a reform, where you try to sort of, where you try to have reasonable limits on punitive damages and maybe caps on some of these damages, would be a way of both allowing consumers who are hurt by irresponsible behavior to get recourse, but also to do it in a way that doesn't randomly wipe out entrepreneurs who haven't done anything to deserve that, right, of that magnitude. Right. So, I mean, that's my first impression. But there's more to be said on this. This is one of those topics where I feel like I should have said more, and deserves more attention than I gave it.
Well, good. If you get around to it, I would also look, if I may suggest, at the irresponsible consumer. The lady you referred to who spilled coffee in her lap, I believe, was driving, and she was guilty of irresponsibility, I would have thought, based on my recollection of the event. So it should go both ways, the irresponsible entrepreneur and the irresponsible consumer, and let's figure out where the balance is.
Right. I'm with you.
Yeah. One other thing that I'm not sure is in your book or not, Art, is you mentioned that you're teaching entrepreneurs and entrepreneurship. So that's a question we always ask here, Art. Can you teach entrepreneurship? Is it something that can be taught, or is it a matter of attitude and personal style? Is it a set of behavioral traits? Do you think that you can teach entrepreneurship?
Well, since I'm trying to do it, I struggle with it. I'm an objective person, right? Because my self-interest is to spin my answer towards saying yes. I want you to take my class. But I'm going to give, you know, economists are criticized justly, I think, for saying on the one hand this and on the other hand that. You know, the famous story that Harry Truman was asked, what do you want for your birthday? And he told somebody, I want a one-handed economist, because I'm tired of economists saying on the one hand this and on the other hand that. And yet I'm going to be the kind of economist that Harry Truman would be annoyed at.
Feel free.
I think it's hard to give a straight answer to this one. We had, when I was a young professor, one of the deans of my college brought in someone who is a fairly distinguished entrepreneur locally. And I or somebody asked him this question that you're asking me, can you teach entrepreneurship? And his answer was no. He said, you've either got the fire in your belly or you don't have the fire in your belly. And if you don't have the fire in the belly, there's no way that a teacher can give it to you. And I think there is something to that, but I think there's still a lot that can be taught that's useful, even maybe a few things that are vaguely related to fire in the belly. I think that, you know, if you go back to that example of the Borgenics with their sewing machine, you can teach people how to sew. So at least for the free agent entrepreneurs, you can teach them some of the skills that they then might apply in their entrepreneurship. You can also teach people some skills, some sort of general principles that maybe are common sense, but maybe not everybody would realize. For instance, that you should go out and see who else is selling the product that you are thinking you want to sell, and what are they pricing it at? There's a book that I think is a nice book in some ways called Blue Ocean Strategy. And they said that in this Blue Ocean Strategy, they mm-hmm. say, if you're an entrepreneur, you want to look for a product to sell where nobody else is selling it. The reason why it's Blue Ocean is that where there's competition, the ocean is full of red blood because there's so much fighting going on. So you want to be in a spot where there's nobody else you have to fight, so the ocean stays blue and beautiful. That's the analogy, I think. Anyway, the Borgenick did was he went out and he found a product nobody was selling, these, you know, simple aprons. You could tell people, well, do that sort of thing. We can't tell you ought to do clothes. But whatever it is you're going to do, think about whether your version of it is going to have a market and whether it's going to have competition. You can tell people that sort of thing. You can tell people, there's a nice little paper by Eddie Lazier, and he's written a few things on entrepreneurship. He's sort of a member of the Chicago School. And he did a little paper where he had access, because he was a Stanford professor, he had access to data that nobody else had access to on the MBA alumni from Stanford. And they had a simple variable about whether the alums had become entrepreneurs. And so what he did was he looked at what course background did the entrepreneurs have versus people who did other things with their MBA. And what he found was that there was a strong relationship in that the people who had become entrepreneurs had a very balanced set of courses. They hadn't specialized in any one subfield of business. And his general argument was then that this makes sense. It's plausible because what you need as an entrepreneur is you need in some ways to be, especially at the early stages, you need to be a jack of all trades. You're not going to have at the early stages the resources to hire all the specialized people you need. So it's, you benefit if you know a little bit of finance, if you know a little bit of accounting, if you know a little bit of marketing, a little bit of human resources and all that. So that's plausible. And that's one thing I say in answer to this question. I say, I maybe can't give you the brilliant insight, the brilliant new idea, but one thing that we can teach you is we can teach you some of the basic skills that will reduce the chances that something will go wrong as you try to implement and execute your bright idea. And you can give cases where things did go wrong for entrepreneurs, where maybe if they'd known more of that sort, they wouldn't have gone wrong. I tell stories about one of my favorite innovative entrepreneurs is Walt Disney. And in his early years, Walt Disney's first famous cartoon character was Oswald the Lucky Rabbit. And he had written a contract with the distributor for Oswald. Well, it turns out that in the contract, the way the contract was written, the ultimate owner of Oswald, if he chose to take advantage of it, was the distributor. And he chose to take advantage of it. So there's a scene in the life of Walt Disney where a dejected Walt Disney is traveling back from New York on a train, having his main cartoon character taken away from him. Of course, what Walt Disney does, and this again is something that happens with innovative entrepreneurs, is he starts doodling, and he shortens the ears of the rabbit, and he lengthens the tail, and he creates Mortimer the Mouse. Except his wife says Mortimer's not a very good name. Why don't you call it something friendlier like Mickey? So it didn't ruin Walt, but Walt might have done better if he'd had some of the more practical knowledge of contract writing that might have made a difference. And I do think part of what these issues are not the main ones I've puzzled about. The main issue I've puzzled about is if somebody wants to be an innovative entrepreneur, what can we say and what can we teach about the process of creativity and innovation? And I think that's a very hard question, a fascinating question. People have written a lot about it. They've given a lot of advice about how to be creative. Not all the advice is consistent with the one person's advice with another person's advice. And I think this is an area I'd like to know more about. I say a little bit about it in the book, but I think this would be a topic that would be worthy of a lot more attention. And if I have time, it's something I'd like to do more about.
Yeah, yes, indeed. Well, our point of view is that it's empathy that is the great skill, being able to put yourself in the mind of the customer and understand what their dissatisfactions and uneasiness might be so that then you can apply creativity to solve the problem. So there was a report recently by Deloitte that says that empathy is an innate attribute, but it can be amplified with experience and education. So
Clay Christensen writes about this some in The Innovator's Solution, and he says that what you need to do as a marketer is not just run surveys about whether people want your particular product, because oftentimes they won't have enough imagination to see how they could use it, and so they might vote down a product that they actually would love once it was on the market. This is the guy who came up with the Walkman said the Walkman would have been an example of that. But what Christensen says you need to do is you need to think about, I don't know if he uses the word empathy, but he could have used the word empathy because it would fit. You need to think about what mm-hmm. job does the consumer need to have done.
Right, jobs to be done. I remember that.
And then you need to think about, would your product do that job? And if it does, then you can fill in the missing step of explaining to the consumer, here's a job I observe you need to have done in your life, and here's how my product will get that job done for you. But it does require some empathy. You have to put yourself in the place of that person and think about, in that person's lives, what jobs do they need to have done.
Well, Art, we need to wrap up, disappointingly, but the clock is running. You've been very eloquent in describing entrepreneurship and the heroism of it, and you've told great stories, so thank you for doing that. I would like to ask you to, as you leave, give us a summary of whether you're optimistic or pessimistic about the future of entrepreneurship in America, given your concerns about regulation and the law and the culture. So are you Are you smiling optimistically?
I have a neutral look on my face. I think that I'm very optimistic about what is possible, but that's different from being optimistic about what will happen. And part of the problem about being optimistic about what will happen is that I don't control totally what will happen. I don't even always totally control what I do, but I sure don't control what other people do. There's a nice passage in Adam Smith where he says that the planner thinks that people are like the pieces of a chessboard, where you can move them any way you want. But in the real human society, every human being has a motive power of their own, and that's what makes planning, central planning, impossible. It's also what makes prediction impossible. Because you're asking me to predict what will happen, and it depends on what all these individual chess pieces decide to do. To some extent, that's what it depends on. I mean, you can still say something, though, because you can say, here are trends, and here are ways that we can change possibly trends or not change trends, and that gives you some reason to have hope or to have fear. I had Schumpeter, as you mentioned earlier in our talk, was a pessimist, and my favorite professor in college who had a big influence on me was a big fan of Schumpeter and was also a pessimist. And there's a passage in Schumpeter that my professor Rogge used to quote when I would say, well, you're so pessimistic, doesn't that cause us despair? And he would say that even if the ship is going to sink and you're sure of it, you still should run for the pumps. And I think about that often. It's never been clear to me that that's right, even though Rogge was right 99% of the time. This might have been the one time he was wrong, because it seems to me like if you really were sure that the ship's going to sink, then maybe you ought to run for a good bottle of brandy.
The lifeboat.
I think that it's not, we aren't sure the ship is going to sink, and so we should run for the pumps. I think there's worrisome signs we talked about, but I think there's also there's positive signs. We have good arguments and good evidence, and I think there is this bedrock of values that the vast majority of people share. They want freedom. They want choice. They want a better life for themselves. They want hope for a better future. And so I think if we can be articulate and persevere, we can make that case strongly. And if we make the case strongly, I think enough people will agree that the ship can be kept afloat and can travel faster toward good things.
Right. Well, good. Thank you. You've been very generous with your time today. We're going to link to your book on our Economics for Entrepreneurs website page, to your personal website. You gave me a couple of other items to highlight, and we'll certainly do that.
Well, I appreciate that. And I've much enjoyed our conversation.
Yeah, me too. Thank you very much. You're very generous, and I learned a lot, and maybe when we talk again, I'll try and make more of an optimist out of you.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Economics for Entrepreneurs is a production of the Mises Institute. To explore more content like this, visit Mises.org. That's Mises.org. For more from Hunter Hastings, check out HunterHastings.com.